No, I referenced what we were talking about the last year.
I heard that there's a case of serial murder in order to, if there's a charge of convicting and locking up a serial murderer by doing a
Sure. Okay, I think I'm out of line. Listen to me.
Okay. I want to begin by speaking about Kavurat Ever Minachai. Last time we spoke about burial of dead bodies and exactly what constitutes a dead body, shitot, of what requires burial and what does not require burial. Today we turn briefly to the question of Ever Minachai, burial of body parts from live people, either amputations or excisions or what have you. What it says in the Gemara is muke shchin she'evrehem noflim oshechotchim otam. Sounds like a leprosy patient, doesn't it? Leprosy, I think, is a fascinating disease. Leprosy is a very, very fine example of an epidemic disease, an infectious epidemic disease, which all by itself has vanished from the modern world without vaccination, and no one knows why it's just vanished. But Yerushalayim has closed its last leper hospital. In any event, back in those days they had lepers, and the skin was falling, the limbs were falling. That's what happens if you're leprosy, your limbs fall off. Don't they have? There is a way of treating it, but there's no longer any need to use the treatment because the disease has vanished.
But it's in the third world.
Oh, in the third world it still exists, yes, and it can be arrested. If it's detected, from the time it's detected, it can be. The progress of the disease can be arrested. It cannot be reversed, but it can be arrested. It calls for early detection, obviously. So, al kol panim, the Gemara speaks about the limbs of the leper falling off. Hayu kovrim et zro'otehem. When their arms fell off, they used to bury their arms. I guess got someone to else did it. I don't suppose the leper did it himself because his arms fell off. Now, in the Shulz Yaakov, he writes, Ein ze mitzad chiyuv lekibor. The fact is that they used to bury the arms, not because there was a chiyuv min hadin to do so. Bifrat lafi ha-ta'amim d'mivuwa b'perek nigmar hadin d'kvura mishum kapala o mishum bizyonga. The reasons for kavura are all connected with kapara, and this guy no longer has need. This guy does not yet have need for kapara because he can still do tshuva. Okay, he should do tshuva to get kapara. He doesn't need kavura for that purpose. Therefore, lefi tam kapara bevadai lo shayach kevan dehu adayin b'chayim. He should do tshuva. Ve'en lo tzar shuv mechamat evar zeh. It's not a bizayon for his goof to be left unburied because he's still alive, so of course he shouldn't be buried. Oh, it says in Baba Kama, Ika busha lemishkal psaro ulizarko leklavim. The Gemara says that taking someone's flesh and throwing it to the dogs is a busha. If all the Gemara can say about taking someone's flesh and throwing it to their dogs is that it's a busha, mashma, that there's no chiyuv kavura. Because if there were a chiyuv kavura, the Gemara should have said so.
So the idea would be to throw in a closed garbage can?
Right. In a way which is mechubad. Mekol makom tzarich liten b'cheder echad shelo yikansu sham kohanim v'yitamu bo ki ever minachai mitamei. That's the conclusion of the Shvus Yaakov. Of course, if you have a kizayis of the ever minachai, so that is mitamei. It's a problem for kohanim. Chutz min a problem for kohanim. There's no chiyuv kavura. Therefore, if a patient has a tumor removed or a limb amputated or whatever, min hadin, there's no chiyuv kavura on that, according to Shmuel Yaakov. If it's a kezias or more, it's just a problem of tumor for kohanim. And we will be returning to tumor for kohanim in a couple of simon. That's the Shmuel Yaakov.
I don't follow the whole thing.
Yeah.
Why would like Gushan not be, say, even enough of a reason to say that you do kufura because it's a Gushan
lechayim?
Why
would
that not be even enough sar?
Because the other ways that one could be mechumad and not mevazer the body doesn't have to be tafka al yidei kufura.
Oh, that's what you're saying.
The Maharal Diskin question. Simple burial in the ground. That's all we're talking about. Burial in the ground. What about someone who undergoes cremation? Cremation is they burn the body, and now they have on their table an urn with the ashes. And whenever anyone comes to visit, they say, that's, you know, our dear departed relative sitting on the table there. Now, do we have a chiyuv kavura here? Assuming that they do tshuva, or a shomer mitzvot descendant inherits the urn with the ashes, should it be buried?
Afrobal,
but there is Jisa Hano.
My diamond in Poland, they've got the huge, it's a Holocaust monument, they've got a huge
display of the ashes.
The ashes, yes.
Okay, there's a chiyu, there's an Isur Hana on the ashes. Definitely Isur Hana. Mar'eh, just looking at it, is not an Isur Hana. But anything which has an Isur Hana should be disposed of in a way that no one will come to have Hana from it. And therefore, it does make sense to bury the ashes in the garden or something, or just get rid of them, bury them, dispose them in a way that it's clear that no one will have hana from them.
It's possible or permissible to use some kind of art there, or should it be
someone whose body has been burned on purpose, someone who is willfully express the desire that they wish to be cremated, should not be buried in the normal way. So, the Maharal Diskin, the great Rav of Yerushalayim, Pasak al pi divrei Gemara b'ketubot, which we just saw above. Perish Rashi, shetam kavurahu mishum she'eva min achai mitame ke'eva min amet. Mashma dahayu kavrim rak mishum tumah. Since the reason of kavura of eva min achai is in order to avoid the possibility of kohanim being mistamer. So tumah is the only reason to do the kavura, has nothing to do with a mitzvah of kavura, has only to do with avoiding tumah. Al kol panim, ever min achai, eino asur bahana'a, de'im lo kein, hayu tzarich lekovro. Mekol makom, vadai, de'ein kan mitzvah zase me'atara to kavura. If ever min achai has no chiyu of kavura, just a problem of tumah, and as long as one finds a way of dealing with the problem of tumah and keeping kohanim away from it, the problem has been solved.
Consistent with Shusyaka.
What?
Consistent with Shusyaka.
Correct.
The fact that the Maharaj is a Zayin Achai, enough to be
with the Eva Min Amet is Asa Bahano. And
it
is Mutta Bahano.
That's why it's the only reason to carry it for tumah.
Correct. Now, let us consider two kinds of organs for transplantation. We have an organ for transplantation min achai, and an organ for transplantation min hamet. Corneal transplants are typically taken from dead cadavers. The cornea has, there's no particular rush to transplant the cornea. Cornea lives a long time after death. So corneal transplants are typically done from death. There is an isa hanor. Unlike kidney transplants, which are typically done from a live patient, there is no isur hanoa there. Legabe the isur hanoa of the cornea, which gets transplanted into a live patient, Rav Unterman was of the opinion that there is no prohibition, even though in general, ever min ha-met is asur b'hanah, even though that's in general true, it's not true about corneal transplants. The reason it's not true about corneal transplants is because the cornea continues to live in the body of the recipient. Since it continues to live in the body of the recipient, this is not ever min ha-met. And since it's not ever min ha-met, memele, it's mutar b'hanah. About any organ which continues to live in the body of the recipient, it's not dead. At such time as the recipient dies, then there'll be a chiyuv kavura because the recipient's body is dead. Correct. But this is not. But this aver is not dead.
The person's dead.
Rav Unzerman said one cannot apply the halacha in the case where the organ continues to live in the body of the recipient. Metame.
No.
No.
Wouldn't it be simpler to say maybe that because we're talking about a situation
of pikuach nefesh? No, the corneal transplants are not pikuach. We're just correcting blindness, that's all. Other transplants are pikuach nefesh, but the cornea not. Cornea only restores vision. The note of Yehuda wrote, Bevadai, Eva Menachai Metame. Titania, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, La Yitama, Eino Mitame Leivarim, Sheino Mitame Al Ever Minachai Al Aviv, Aval Mitame Hu Leever Minachai, Leever Minamet Shal Aviv. So it turns out, the Ferush from the Gemara in Nazir, that Ever Minachai is Mitame. Aval, the Ever Minachai, Ein Mitzvah Kvura. Masha Kovrima Evarim, Hu Rakla Hatzil Minatuma. So here is a third shita, which brings home again the same point over and over again. It's also in the Malamed Lahoyel. Min hadin, there's no inyan of kvura, there's no mitzvah of kvura, but there is a problem of tumas kohanim, and that could be dealt with in a number of different ways. It's not only these shitas. Tzitz Eliezer also says, mitzvahs kvura min ha-Torah lo nizkara ela al misha met, velo al eivra min ha-chai. Kevan she'ein iser hanoa be'ever min achai, muta l'rofim hitlamed alav be'darchei refuah. Kamuvan, asur l'hashlicho l'achar mekan v'vizayon, ela tzarich l'hatzniyo o l'kavro. But the l'kavro is not mishum mitzvah kvura, it's only mishum tuma, and to be mechubad, be mechabed, and not mevazer, techelkei guf. All this is one approach, which represents the mainstream thinking of the poskim. Now we have a divergent view in the Igris Moshe. Igris Moshe wrote, Divrei Hanodav Yehuda Tmuhim. Igris Moshe is not happy with the approach of the poskim we've seen up till now. The im ein mitzvahs kvura be'ever minachai, lama tzarich kra l'Rabbi Yehuda shelo yitame le'ever minachai shel aviv. Ilu ever minachai lo haya tzarich kvura, yesh lomar she'ein shum tzarech lehitamela, uvelo tzarech ha'ach lameis sholem asu lekohen letamela. The Gemara, which is the basis of the Nodim Yehuda's thinking, is a Gemara which teaches us that a kohen is indeed metame to bury an ever minamet, but he's not metame to bury an ever minachai. Now, if he's not metame to bury an eva minachai, why is the Gemara bother teaching us that if there's no chiyuv kavura? If you don't have to bury it at all, why should the Gemara tell us that a kohen is not metame in order to bury it? Nimtzeinu l'meidim, according to Igris Moshe, that there is a chiyuv kavura on eva minachai.
Meaning, the kohen is not metame to bury it, meaning he will become metame and everyone should bury it.
No, for eva minamet, for an immediate relative, he's required to be metame himself. And if he's reluctant to, so the chachamim are metame him bal korcho, to make him participate in the kavura. But not for ever minacha.
But it would be metame.
It would be metame, right. It would be metame, but he's not allowed to be metame himself with it in order to do the kavura. From this, Igris Moshe learns there must have been a chiyuv kavura, or else why bother teaching us that he's not allowed to participate in the kavura if there's no chiyuv kavura?
But it still doesn't tell us
But does it sort of state as what the makor of the
No. But it flows from the Gemara that there must be such a chiyuv. Elavadai yesh lomar shela Rebbe Yehuda yesh mitzvus kvura be'evah minachai. Umasha kohen enu metame le'evah minachai. Ukamosha enu metame la'aviv chaser. If the father is missing rosho or missing rubo, kohen is also not metame. Asher vadai chayav bekvura. Makom makom, the conclusion of the Igris Moshe is Ein ve'ever minachai din kvura dafka Ela shalom yein mutal bevizayon Lachin sagi besveifa uvechol mine ibud mina olam. Bottom line, Igris Moshe ends up agreeing with the conclusion of all the other poskim. It's true that the Gemara implies that there's a chi of kvura, but kvura lav dafka. It just means getting rid of it in some dignified way. Kevan she'ein tuma ve'ever menachai below basa ve'gidin nimtza she'ein atzarich likbor b'nei me'ayim u'klayot u'tchol u'shfir v'shalia kishaleka adayin tzuras v'lad she'ein sham gidim v'chol ki ha'gavna she'leka etzim. Since in order to have tumas mace you need basa ve'gidin, therefore there's no need for kohanim to be concerned about intestines, kidneys, pancreas, placenta, or any other body parts which don't have a din of basar v'gidim.
So parallel from a mila.
Parallel from a mila. A mila is basar, but it's not a kezayit. And therefore, it's only a minhag because of the very.
Okay?
Okay? So, those are my thoughts on burial of Aver Minachai. Indeed, the Gemara implies that there's a Chiyuv Kavura of Aver Minachai, unlike what all the other poskim say. But then he ends up agreeing with all the other poskim, because he understands the Gemara as meaning Lav dafka kvura. When the Gemara said you have to cover it, what the Gemara really meant was you have to get rid of it in a dignified way. Kvura is only one possibility. So everyone agrees that ever minachai is a problem of tumas kohanim, and bizoyon is asa, therefore must be disposed of in a dignified manner.
What about fetuses?
Same thing. A fetus depends, as he points out, whether it's tsuras vlad, if it's far enough along in gestation that it has tsuras vlad, basar v'gidin, then indeed it's mutame and has to be disposed of in a dignified fashion.
Not necessarily kavura.
Right, not necessarily kavura. If it's so early in gestation that it doesn't yet have tsuras vlad, then it's not mutame, but still one cannot be mutasa.
Nowadays,
we're calling out the order. Yes, big problem. A former student of ours, actually, is responsible for solving one of the irksome halakhic problems of Yerushalayim. As you probably are aware, Wolfson Medical Center in Yerushalayim began performing abortions around 2 years ago. Prior to that, abortions were performed only in medical centers and hospitals. Wolfson was the first non-hospital, it's a medical clinic, where they started doing abortions outside of hospitals. However, the building is a fairly large medical clinic, and not only is it a medical clinic, there are many other things going on in Wolfson Towers, and there are Kohanim all the time, who are going in and out, there are Kohanim who are patients there, that Kohanim will have various reasons to be going in and out of there, and now all of a sudden, beginning around 2 years ago, there's regularly more than a kezayit of Eva Menachai, namely the products of abortions. So meaning Kohanim cannot go in there. This is an irksome problem. A former Talmud of ours put in a lot of time and effort going around to different Rabbanim, and working out a solution to this problem. The problem has now been solved, and although they still do abortions, there is no longer a tumas ohel there. Let's turn to one of my favorite topics. Everyone knows that you're not supposed to be goyish. Now, you're not supposed to be goyish. Now, what exactly this means turns out to be a machlokas poskim, which has its center in Hilchos Aveilus, Kafka in the Hilchos Kavurim. And since this is the center of the issue, so we'll describe it here. You can hear more page 3s? Here's page 3. It says in the Gemara, Sreifa al-Hames. This is like, what do they do in India? When he dies, they burn her also? They still do that in India? And I know they did it. There's a scene in Around the World in 80 Days where they did that. It's probably available on DVD now. Sreifa al-Hames, lav chukah d'avodah zarah. Burning things, burning the property of the deceased in honor of the deceased is not a chuk of avodah zarah. Ela chashivusahi. It's just done because of the chashivus of the mace. It's a way of honoring him. And therefore, it does not fall under the prohibition of avodah zarah. That's what the Gemara says. Okay, now on this Gemara, the Tosfos says in the name of Ri, Trei Gavne Hukahavi. There are two kinds of things which are Hukas Hagoyim. There are two kinds of things which are Goyish and therefore prohibited. Echad, She'osim L'shem Chokla Vodes Kachav. Anything which they do as part of their idol worship, as part of their idolatry, that is chukas agoyim and usher for us to imitate. Ve'echad she'osim l'shem das hevel u'shtus shalayim. And the second thing, which is chukas hagoyim, and therefore goyish and usher for us, is anything which they do with hevel u'shtus. Now, I just point out in passing that if you thumb through that lovely book by Rav Tzvi Shechter on Nefesh HaRav, if you thumb through that lovely book, you will notice very quickly that in the entire book there is exactly one word in English. And the exactly one word in English in the entire book is in response to the question. You know karate? Judo? You know what I'm talking about? The disciples, before slugging it out, bow down to each other. That's the way it's done, right? You bow down to them, and then you start trying to kill them. So the question arises whether or not this is a prohibition of Hishtacharaya. After all, Hishtachavoy is one of the five avodot of the Beis HaMikdash, and all of the avodot of the Beis HaMikdash are prohibited because of avodah zarah, if you do it for an avodah zarah. In addition to the five avodot of the Beis HaMikdash, anything else which the of the avodah zarah do is also asa. But the five avodot of the Beis HaMikdash are surely asa if done in connection with, if done for avodah zarah. So the Rav was asked whether or not it's permissible for the disciples to bow down to each other before commencing to slug it out. To which the Rav responded, according to what it says in Nefesh HaRav, that's stupid. Now, one might wonder, well, no, stupid is the only word. That's stupid in quotation marks. Stupid. One might wonder how this is an answer to the question whether or not you're allowed to do it. Well, of course, anyone familiar with the Ri in the Tosfos knows that das hevel vashtus shelahem, any hevel vashtus of the goyim, is usher deraisa for us to imitate because it's chukas agoyim. So if it's the opinion of the Rav that the bowing down is stupid, it follows that it is not a prohibition of avodah zarah. it's only a prohibition of chukas agoyim, which although it's also aser deraisa, at least doesn't fall into the category of geherek val yavor.
So yeah. You can't apply that to just like Sreifah Mace if it's done for cover.
We'll come to this conclusion in a moment. Now, according to the maskana of the sugya in the Gemara, Sreifa lav chukahi l'shem avodas kachavim. Mekol makom hi chok hevel v'shtus. Avodah Zarah, it might not be, but stupid it is. And therefore, although it indeed is not an Isur of Avodah Zarah, it still is an Isur deraisa of Chukas Agoyim, Darchei Ha'emorim. Lahachi, afilu rimo de delo gamrinin di'i, lo gamrinin minayhu, iksivu v'deraisa. Now, Ri has to agree, that anything we do, because it's written in the Torah somewhere, anything we do because it's written in the Torah, we're not imitating Goyim, we're doing it because it says in the Torah. And therefore, if we do anything we do because there's a Torah source for it, we've saved ourselves, we've escaped the Isur of Chukas HaGoyim, we're not imitating Goyim, we're doing it because it says in the Torah. Could be that Goyim do exactly the same thing for Hevel V'Shtus Shalahem. But we're not doing it in imitation of the Goyim, we're doing it because it's written in the Torah.
Someone gets something that's overloaded, they're being over a Zara and
Darkhemori? Yeah, no, they're definitely being over a Vodah Zara, and in all likelihood, there's Darkhemori because in all likelihood they're imitating some Goyish behavior. It's unlikely that we're talking here about an Avodah Zarah that the Jew invented all by himself and didn't copy from the Goyim, right?
It's a non-Jewish Avodah Zarah.
Right.
Something that
copied from the Goyim, but it's still there.
They're over two things, whereas right. They did something that was just stupid and they're
over one. Correct. Similarly, if they invent their own Avodah Zarah, then they're not copying it from Goyim, also only over Avodah Zarah. Okay.
Watching TV.
Watching, what is that? The Kufsata Tuma. Right.
Temple
Lysia. I also read the Ig.
I wonder
what the original English was.
Temple
Lysia. Because the Ig was written in English. Anyone has Bacchius in the BFG in English? In Hebrew, it's called Temple Lysia. What was the original English?
No.
The BFG in Hebrew is the Ig.
The what?
Ig. Anak Yedidut Gadol. In Hebrew, it's Tembel Vizier. But I don't know what the original English was. I have no Bakias in the Royal Gaul in English. The Akolpanit. The Tosfos agrees. Ilo Havaksiva Baraisa. It's not printed so clearly here. Ilo Havaksiva Baraisa. Something which does not have a source in the Torah. Something which does not have a source in the Torah, it's usur for us to imitate their stupid behavior. Okay? If it has a source in the Torah, so we're not imitating them. We're doing it because it says in the Torah.
Apparently in Japan, in the lower one bows, the more respect one is given to the person to whom one is bowing.
Uh-huh.
So, in the case of the Judo's forest, if one should, for example, meet deep by somebody, Japanese, who bows, and one does it.
Mm-hmm. But the problem is that with the crumbling of traditional Japanese society, I think it's only people over the age of 65 who still have a sense of honor and dignity in Japan. There are very few people under the age of 65 who know how these things work there anymore. If you visit South America, the first thing which will strike your ear is the use of tu instead of usted. Tu instead of usted. Or boss. Yes? It strikes the ear immediately when you speak with an Argentinian. This kind, It's T instead of V. T instead of V.
Ah.
The and this kind of crumbling of traditional sense of honor and dignity is typical in post-war Japan, as it is in post-war Germany and Italy. The Axis powers seem to have lost their sense of honor and respect. In Switzerland, one is still very strict in the distinction between du and sie. Very strict. In Germany, not. And in Italy, one no longer hears lei. One no longer hears lei in Italian. Lei, loro. It's simply fallen out of use in the younger generation.
What about voi for the singular?
No. Nothing.
Really
locked out, no? Yeah. Oh, that's been the early 18th century that began to fail. So, it remains, I think, only in French. Yeah. Only in French.
Who?
No, Ustedes is used for both, you know, in Spain.
I was thinking about
as opposed to Yao. Yeah. Now, the Afrikaner distinguishes between Yao and you.
Yes.
Okay, so that's the old, and it would be insulting to say Yao to someone to whom you should say you. Of course, the English were the first to destroy all sense of honor and dignity in language, dispensing with the vowel and using ye for you for everyone. So the conclusion is, kol she'eino chok l'avodah zarah, assuming number one that something is not for avodah zarah, and number two, ilo minayhu gamrinin, we didn't learn it from them, we're not copying them, like a mishum b'chukotei motelechu, then it's mutter. In order to figure out what's mutter, either there are two conditions. It must simultaneously not be a avodah zarah and not come from the goyim. If it's neither of those, then we're allowed to do it.
If it's in the Torah, even if we're not doing it.
Well, why would we? If we do it, we're doing it because it's in the Torah. Right?
Definition.
Right. Now Rav Avadia points out, that not only is a biblical source sufficient to excuse us, to save us from the Isur of the Chukotem Lekelechu? It doesn't have to be a biblical source. Something which comes from the Mishnah, the Gemara, the Midrash, Chazal. So something which we do not because we're imitating the Goyim, but because it has a Jewish literary source. It doesn't have to be Mikra. We also save ourselves from the Chukosei Mosei Lechu. So, but bottom line, bottom line is, in order to escape the prohibition, two things are required. Number one, it has to not be a avodah zarah, obviously. And number two, it has to not come from the goyim. It has to come from a Jewish source. That's the shita of the Tosfos. As broadened a little bit by the Yabbi Omer, the Tosfos mentions only Mikra. Yabbi Omer says, of course, it means anything which is a true, authentic Jewish source, like the Zohar.
Now,
Zohar should be good enough.
Why is it Zohar
good enough? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. V'chi yesh chotim al zeh?
It's not a place that's being that's Michael. Why is it being that's Mark? You're saying you have a source in Zohar in your practice, even though it's also a non-Jewish practice. Is that a problem?
Because we're not copying Goyim, we're doing it because of the Jewish source.
Does the Abiyam Omer Dabkas say
the Zohar? Not in this tshuva, but in many other tshuvas he does rely upon the Zohar as a source. I am aware of the fact that the Rabbanim disagree amongst themselves about the provenance of the Zohar. I know full well that Yaakov Emden thought that the Zohar is not of Tana'itic origin, but of course the majority view is that the Zohar is ancient. The antiquity of the Zohar is the ancient, is the majority view of the poskim. So can one poskim like the majority in a historical question? If so, Rova Poskim holds that the Zohar is of ancient origin. I just point out in passing that linguistically speaking, there's no doubt that the Zohar is ancient. The Zohar uses a number of anomalous linguistic forms. What would be a good example? You know, in Hebrew, you know metathesis, where you have to reverse the order of the letters? You take a root like samach, kaf, lamed, lehistakel. Somehow the taf of hitpael and the samach of the root, the order got switched. Lehistakel, which is the normal thing in Hebrew, it's a normal thing in Aramaic as well. Istakel is a normal thing in Aramaic as well. Except in 2nd century Aramaic, Aramaic, as spoken in the 2nd century, failed to reverse the order of the letters. And in the 2nd century, the word to look in Aramaic was not istakel, but itsakel, with the taf before the samach. Now, although this is true in 2nd century Aramaic, it survived in no Jewish texts. That is, there's no way that a Jew living in medieval Spain could have known that in 2nd century Aramaic, the word was spelled taf samach and not samach taf. Nonetheless, in the Zohar, that's the way it's spelled. Because we have documents which were subsequently discovered from that period of time, documents which could not have been known in Spain.
And we don't have any Russian
letters? No. In Jewish sources, the metathesis always occurs, inevitably, except in the Zohar, and in recently discovered 2nd century Aramaic texts. This is one example. Examples like this can be multiplied, demonstrating that from a linguistic point of view, the Zohar is surely of ancient origin. I point out in passing that I've collected 6 quotations of the Zohar in early patristic literature. The patristic literature is the literature created by the founders of the Christian Church. And in that literature, which is quite large, it takes up shelves in the library, four quotations, I'm pretty sure of, two are a little bit shaky, 6 quotations of the Zohar in the 2nd and early 3rd century.
It's called the Zohar.
No. The Goy is discussing the meaning of some pasuk in the Torah, and the Goy, in the course of the discussion, says a Jew told me the following interpretation, and it's something crazy, something off the wall, something you would never dream up by yourself, and it exists nowhere in Jewish literature except in the Zohar.
Possible that the
Baal
Zohar had some kind of tradition.
How did the Baal Zohar know patristic literature?
No, it's some kind of tradition that was also known to the, well, that's a different possibility, but they had to have some kind of tradition, that there was a Jewish tradition of this interpretation, which was known to the Baal Zohar because it was passed down.
Zohar also speaks about the founders of Islam from the 6th century. It's clear, as Rabbi Yaakov Emden pointed out, that certain layers of the Zohar are late accretions, later layers that were added. After all, Zohar talks about the founders of Islam. That can't be from the 2nd century. Islam is from the 6th century. But elements of the Zohar are surely ancient. That's all I can conclude on the basis of the linguistic evidence. After all, a few scattered ancient linguistic forms here doesn't prove that the whole thing is ancient. Proves at least certain layers of it are ancient. And a few quotations of the text in ancient literature doesn't prove the whole thing is ancient, but proves that at least there are ancient layers in it. I could tell if one could discuss many more proofs along this line. This is not the place for it.
Can I ask a question about Shin-Tat-Tos?
Yeah.
Would a clothing style be considered?
Yeah. Rabbi Yosef Kalon at the bottom of the page is going to say that. Rabbi Yosef Kalon is going to say that, but wait till the bottom of the page. We end one sheet of the Tosfos, and we begin a whole new sheet, all different sheet in understanding the Issa here, the sheet of the Ran. A whole different sheet, Machlokis. The Ran says, Lo asra Torah ela chukot shel avodas kachavim shem dvarim shel hevel ubatala. V'yesh v'hem tzorech, or srach, avodas kachavim. Aval dvarim shel tam, kigon dvarim shehem b'shum kavod, mutarim. This is a whole different understanding. Remember that Tosfos said, it's aser, unless it's free of avodah zarah, and not imitating them. Ran says, no, it's aser if it's shtus. The heter, according to the Ran, is not like the Tosfos. The heter, according to the Ran, is if there's some rational explanation for what you're doing. You're bowing down in a certain way to express honor and respect for the person. Well, that's perfectly rational, I understand. That's like shaking someone's hand. If I refuse to shake his hand, it's disrespectful. If I shake his hand, it's an expression of honor and respect. Perfectly rational reason why I'm doing it. As long as there's a clear, rational explanation for the conduct, then it's okay. What's prohibited is conduct which has no rational explanation to it. Throwing salt over your shoulder, knocking on wood, stepping on the cracks, you're not supposed to step on the cracks, whatever it is, the conduct which has no rational explanation to it, that's what Asa Mina Torah.
Does that same
agree
with the shaking person's hand
with your bow? Since we learned it from them, Asa. Unless you can find some mucker for it in the Gemara, you search hard, you might find shaking hands.
That's
Lufia Tosfos. Lufia Tosfos, Asra, unless you find a mucker in the Gemara for it.
Really, they talk about the Keskaf?
Not in the Gemara, it's in the Rishonim.
Okay.
But that's not for a greeting or an expression of dignity, that's a kinyan.
Right.
Something else.
Is it possible to understand Tosfos when they say handle the shoes? You need something that they're doing that's stupid rather than something that they're doing that's
going
to it?
Okay, it's possible, but it's the shelahem that makes it aser. Gamrinin minayu, that's what makes it aser. It's the imitative nature of the conduct which prohibits it according to the Tosfos. It's the, according to the Ran, it's the irrational element which makes it aser. And we'll see how, in a moment, how different poskim break up along these lines.
Otman's a more subjective, according to what you're saying, seems to be very subjective.
No.
What about the kind of...
According to the Ran?
Yeah.
Explain to me the reason, and I'll do it too. If you can explain to me a good reason, so I'll also do it. If you can't explain to me the reason, then it's chukas hagoyim, and it's also. If there's a good reason, I'll do it also. Yeah? Okay. Now, let's finish with the Ran. In the Chidushim, he says, HaTorah asra kol minhag miyuchad lenimusei avodes elivim. Shema yimashech ha'adam achareyem. Lachein, im akusim, nahagu be'ezem minhag, she'en lo mavo b'darchei ha'teva, v'lo nit'amet ha'nisayon, ha'osek kemosan over mishum darchei ha'mon. The point again, in the Chidushim of the Ran, just like the Ran on the Rif, the point is the same. Something which has a rational explanation to it is mutter. Something which has no rational explanation to it is prohibited because it's copying goyish ways.
Now, it's an example that was about throwing salt over the shoulder. What about the minhag on even the surface of cutting grass and throwing grass?
Is that what they do? The Goyim do that, or we do that?
We do it.
Okay, we're not imitating the Goyim. Since we're not imitating the Goyim, since it has a makar in halacha, it's okay. Now, these are the two main shittas, the Tosfos and the Ran. From now on, the discussion is going to revolve around how to paskin and whether we can somehow join these shittas together. The Maharik, Rabbi Yosef Kalon, is the shita which forms the basis of the thinking of all the acharonim on the question of Darchei Ha'amori or Chukas Hagoyim, two names for the same thing. It's the Shita of the Maharik we're about to learn, which is the cornerstone of the thinking of the acharonim. He says, Ein la esor mishum b'chukoseim lo seilechu ela v'achad mishnei chalakim. These are the two things which are prohibited as Darchei Ha'amori or Chukas Hagoyim according to the Maharik. One, Davar asher ein ta'amo nigla. Kidemashma loshen chok, shu gezeres ha-melech, she'ein tamu davar. The Rishonim explained to us that in the Torah there are chukim and mishpatim. The chukim are the things which are gezeres ha-melech and we don't know a rational explanation for them. So chukis agoyim are the things they do for which there is no known rational explanation. Lefi zeh, ha'osa davar mishuneh, asher ein bo tam nigleh, ela shehem noagim kein, az nireh vadai, ki nimshach achareihem, u'modeh lehem. Di'im lochein, lama ya'aser kedvarim ha'tmuhim ha'ela. So any non-Jewish conduct for which we have no rational explanation is prohibited for us to copy.
Modern religious scholars who do comparative religion talk about how
syncretism.
Yes.
Syncretism is not recognized by halacha. Syncretism. Yeah, it's a word which means joining together, molding together different religious practice from different religions.
Like korbanot.
No. That's from the Torah. The more interesting question. It's in the Torah. The more interesting question is things which are not in the Torah. For example, I don't know if you've ever attended a Jewish wedding. If you attend a Jewish wedding, you might notice that the bride wears a white gown. Where did that come from? And you might further notice that the groom places upon her finger a ring. Where did that come from?
Isn't that for Kenyan?
I understand that a ring can be Kesef or perhaps Shava Kesef, but why in the shape of a ring?
The Zohar talks about it.
Exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Beyond syncretism, there's another one. People talk about how.
I used to live in Boston, where the wife of the Bostoner Rebbe, she was the Bostoner Rebbetzin, told me once that at her wedding, when she was married, she did not wear a white dress, so as not to imitate shtus shalahem.
Did she?
A colored dress.
So many people say that in order to understand the logic of religion, one must enter into it to see its own internal logic. So from that perspective, where's the line drawn when it comes to saying Shtush on heaven? Because if one understands the entire context of another religious practice, then certain specific practices make a lot of sense.
Yeah. So the rabbis, of course, have no interest at all in looking at the other religion from within the other religion. And if that's what's required, if it cannot make sense to me, the outside observer, then that's what we call shtus. Shtus shalahem. Okay. Now. So.
How do you explain the white dress?
I pose it. There's something to think about.
I don't think you wear a black suit as well. The groom wears a white top for his
kittle. He wears a kittle because it's Hazkir Yom HaMita or something like this. But to the best of my knowledge, the Kala is not going to wear her white dress next to Yom Kippur.
Can the state students has more rabbi than rabbi?
Yeah, of course, if one looks at old photographs, well, most of which have been suppressed, I know that when the CIA mistakenly posted photographs of Iraqi facilities for purifying uranium. When the CIA mistakenly published those photographs on the CIA internet site yesterday, for a period of around an hour and a half, before someone called them up and informed them that they were revealing military secrets on the internet, and therefore the photographs were removed. But it's a lesson to remember: an hour and a half on the internet is enough to give you eternity. So many people copied those photographs in that hour and a half time. Now they're available all over the place. An hour and a half on the internet can give you eternity. Now, the old photographs of Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, the great Torah leader of Frankfurt, it's hard to find those old photographs. I'm honored to own a few copies myself. He used to wear a tolaka. I don't know why you call it tolaka in English. It's a kind of collar which has ribbons. Tolaka, it's called. There's a name for it in English. It looks suspiciously similar to what Protestant pastors were wearing in those days, and there was a great controversy among the Orthodox rabbis of Europe whether it's permitted or prohibited to wear that. Many of the Orthodox rabbis of Europe held that it's absolutely prohibited to wear such a thing. But I have photographic evidence that the Prince Raphael Hirsch held otherwise. Why did he hold? The reason for the heter, although the Prince Raphael Hirsch never spoke about it, I assume that the reason for the heter is that there's a rational explanation why to wear it. Namely, at this time, in this place, in this society, this is mechubad. And therefore, if you want people to relate to you in a mechubad way, if you're the Rishon LeZion, I remember the day after Rabbi Amar, our current Rishon LeZion, the current incumbent, the day after he received the appointment, he made the mistake of appearing in public without the getup, you know, like without the embroidery, you know, and he was severely criticized for that in the newspapers. Part of the covet of the position. Yeah, part of the covet of the position. Yeah, now he started to put it on.
Really?
Yeah. They think it's covered. As soon as they think it's covered, that I understand. There's no particular reason why shaking hands has to be an expression of covered. Society could have invented something else. Society could have invented shaking of little fingers. But society developed this as an expression of covered. And if I refuse to do it, I'm insulting the person. No, but it's rational. And therefore I'm allowed to copy. Therefore I'm allowed to copy their conduct. Rain dance rational, but it works. Yes, it's rational.
You have to, you know,
In the days of the Chidush Yarim. The Chidush Yarim was the founder of Gera, the Hasidut Gur, which is by far the largest Hasidic group. They were the largest Hasidic group before the Shoah. Poland was more or less wall-to-wall Gera Hasidim. Today, they are by far the largest group in all over the world. They're the largest group. And not many left Poland, I suppose. The Chidush Yarim, who was a Talmud of Reb Simcha Bunim of that town that only people who come from there can pronounce it. How do you say it?
Pshishcha.
Pshishcha, yeah. Okay, people come from that, not from that. The founder of Hasidut Gur back in the days when the Tsar in Peterburg made a gezeirah neged ha-Yehudim, insisting that the Jews of Poland, which were under the Tsar in those days, the Jews of Poland were ordered by the Tsar, commanded by the Tsar, to wear Western dress. Now this upset the Chidushei Harim terribly, as it upset many others. And he did not want his Hasidim to wear goyish dress, and therefore, being a very clever person, he thought of a solution. The solution was, he sent a shliach to the court of the Tsar in Peterburg with a petition to the Tsar saying, "Oh, Tsar, dear Tsar, could you kindly give permission to your loyal subjects in Poland to dress like your loyal servants, the Russian serfs?" The slaves on the farms.
What year was this?
This was 20 years ago. Less than 20 years, 170 years ago.
So before they freed the serfs.
Right. Now, this put the Tsar in a difficult position. He couldn't say, "No, don't dress like my serfs." Right? So he said, "Okay, the Jews of Poland have a choice. They can either wear Western dress, or they can dress like the serfs in Russia." So Chidush Yerim told all the Hasidim to dress like the serfs in Russia, and that's the source of the weekday Hasidic dress. The hat, the coat, all
that.
That's the kind of hat. That's where the Kovah Shachor comes from.
He didn't accept them.
Yeah, it all comes from that. If you're interested in pursuing this issue, there's a lovely chapter in Yitzchak Alfasi's book, Hasidut Gur. Yitzchak Alfasi has a lovely chapter in the book. He tells the whole story with all the sources. You see it there. Streimel, believe it or not, there was originally a rational reason to wear a streimel. It's warm, right? Streimel is a good habit. In the cold Polish winter, streimel, anyone who could afford it would wear a fur hat because that kept you warm. And today, the streimel, it doesn't matter. You can walk in the snow, walk in the rain. I mean, nothing bothers a streimel. I mean, mink, sobel. They're going to have sobel, no? Sobel. Mink, Tzobel.
So why that put Shabbos? Is that cold during the winter?
Well, covered.
No, you're allowed to tolerate the cold during the winter.
No, sins. It's a beged of wealthy people. Someone who wants to be Mechaber Shabbos with special dress, so that's a way to be Mechaber Shabbos, the way wealthy people dress. In a moment, we're going to see a list of reasons, and once we get the list of reasons, then we'll be able to generalize for that. In a moment, we're getting a list of reasons. They're dressed like Jews.
What do Jews look like?
If you're interested, I encourage you to go to the National Library. In the National Library, there's an art section. The art section of the library has a whole shelf of books on the history of costume, the history of dress. There's a whole section in the art library of the National Library. The books are organized by century, and you can have books of Jewish dress, books of Goyish dress, and if you want to see the way people dressed in any particular time or place, you have all of the pictures there in the art library.
The classic picture of the serf up against the classic would be hard for us to discern.
Correct. Now, how does it work, incidentally, in London today? As long as the Jew was living in a shtetl in Poland, where the Jews dressed differently from the Goyim, and you could tell whether or not someone is a Jew or a Goy at 100 meters. A glance at 100 meters will tell you whether or not someone is a Jew or a Goy, because they dressed very differently. In that context, if a Jew would start dressing like a Goy, that would be b'chukotehem lo telechu, that would be imitating shtus v'hevel shalahem, and definitely asim. Take the same Jew and fly him to London, where in London you see someone in the city or Piccadilly Circus walking down the street wearing a tweed suit and a bowler with a tightly furled brolly. Have I got it right? They actually walk around like that, or it's only in the pictures? They really walk around like that? If they have, there's no sense of busha. You see someone walking down the street like that, there's no way to tell by looking at him whether he's Jewish or a Goy, because in the context of London dress, that uniform, that style of dress is neutral and conveys no message at all about the religion of the wearer. Therefore, in London or New York, the Igris Moshe concludes, it's okay to wear civilian dress. There's no chiyuv to be dressed in a way distinctively Jewish. There's only an isur to dress in a way that's goyish. But what makes it goyish? It makes it goyish only if you are copying them. If Jews also dress that way, it turns out to be entirely okay. Now, it follows from this approach of the Igris Moshe, it follows that the first ones who changed were truly wrong. And it was usur for them to have done so. And had they asked, they would have been told, no, it's usur to change into Gentile-style clothing. But once many had done it, and now it's no longer possible to tell who is Jewish and who isn't by looking, now all of a sudden it becomes mutter. Now when the 101st person asks the Rav, can I change from a long black coat and a big round hat into ordinary Gentile? Now the answer is yes.
If someone of those first Jewish people are dressed in a way which is
in the shtetl? No, as long as they're wearing something that makes that identifies them as being Jewish, it's okay. Something which identifies them as a Jew, save them from the East.
If it was a converse, if that was what they were wearing before, does that make a difference?
No, once he's a convert, he's Tinoch Shinola Dummy, now everything starts afresh.
Okay, so do we count non-Jewish Jews,
it's only observant Jews. Only observant Jews.
So the first of the
Kedush
Harim was Israel.
Yeah, but that was a little bit different because there were no Russians in Poland at the time. So wearing the Russian garments in Poland did not give anyone the impression that you're a Russian Goy. And just they all did it at once, so there were no first people who were awesome.
Why was that less common than having Muslim clothes?
Well, he wanted the Jews to be different from the Goyim. The idea is as follows. Rav Yehuda HaChassid from the Balei Tosfos says in the Sefer Chassidim that someone who wants to be a Chassid should dress in a distinctive, pious fashion. The reason is that the clothing will influence your conduct. If you dress in a particularly pious fashion, you will be embarrassed to do anything usur, and therefore your clothing will keep you on the straight and narrow. And therefore, even if you're not such a great tzaddik, it's okay to dress like a great tzaddik, because that the dress alone will force you to behave that way.
That works today?
I think of course it works today. You insist that people dress in a three-piece suit, all of a sudden they'll start behaving differently than if they're in a t-shirt and jeans.
Yeah, we'll do that. That's what I'm saying.
Black, right.
Otherwise, would it be a violation of the seal? Does it deliberately stand out from the clothing?
Yes. Yes, it's a violation of tzniut to dress in a way that, that attracts attention to yourself.
So how would those in the cluster, how could that be a sign of piety?
Talking about a society in which people will not stare at this. Okay, so according to Maharik, the first thing which is aser is shtut vehevel shalahem. The second thing which is aser is davar asher shayach po nidnud pritzat geder hatzniut v'hanava yinhagu bo goyim kidechsiv hishamer lecha pen tinakesh achareihem. So, I cannot send you, I cannot advise you to look at those art books with the pictures of costume from Renaissance Italy in the days of the Maharik, because your eyes would fall upon too many examples of what he's talking about here. Any goyish clothing which violates geder hatzniut is, of course, usher for us to copy, but nowadays, I suppose that's not such a problem. Now, the proof he brings for this is on the top of page 2, a proof from the Sifrei Devarim. These are the words of the Sifrei Devarim. The Sifrei Devarim is the proof for the Maharik. Shalom Tamar, Ho'il Vahem Yotzim B'toga, since the Romans wear a toga, Afani Eitzei B'toga, I too will wear a toga. Ho'il Vahem, you ever saw a toga? Rahumai. Now the toga, if you think about it, while you're looking through those books on history of costume, you'll notice that one of the prime elements in a toga is the absence of buttons. Togas had no buttons, and therefore doing anything, wearing a toga, was not simple. I mean, the thing sort of falls on your shoulder, the thing is just constantly falling off. Just keeping the thing draped over you is a major effort all the time. Like a talus. We don't expect our talus to cover all of us all the time. Whereas the toga, that's all they wore, was a toga. Underwear had not yet been invented.
I thought they wore tunics under the toga. No.
We, however, use buttons. You know buttons? Now, we do not know who invented the button, although we do know that the button was invented in the late 13th century. As you can see, if you look through history of costume books, see all of a sudden, beginning of the 14th century, clothing starts to have buttons. So buttons were invented in the end of the 12th century, and in the 13th century. We don't know who they did. Listen, it's such a clever invention that one cannot believe. We cannot believe that it was done by a seamstress. I mean, no woman could be clever enough to have been buttons, right? Buttons are terribly clever things. I challenge you to write on a single page of paper. I challenge you to write a description of what you explain to me what I have to do to fasten a button. Explain to me in words the flick of the wrist necessary in order to make a button work. It's an incredibly complicated little thing which I challenge you to try to even describe. All of this leads me to pose to you the following question. Since buttons did not exist in antiquity, they had their origins in the 13th century, the practical reason for them is clear, right? Some of them are practical reasons, some of them are decorative, but even if it's decorative, I understand why it's there. It's for decorative purposes. Here's my question. There are a number of halachas which depend upon buttons. For example, everyone tells me that although tofer is an Isur Deraisa on Shabbos, everyone tells me there's no problem at all in buttoning and unbuttoning. And I don't have why. I just don't have what the difference is between buttoning and sewing. So, no. Well, first of all, several buttons. And the only reason why Tfira Achat is okay is because Tfira Achat is not matzmid two badim together. Only the second Tfira is matzmid them together. But a button, a single button, is enough to matzmid two things together.
Is Kesher Klaver invention?
Well, no, Kesher is only required if you do two Tfira. Since you do three Tfira, you don't need a Kesher anymore for it to be Asa Deraisa. So I don't know. Well, I pose it to you to think why buttons should be. See, all of a sudden buttons came on the market in the 13th, 14th century, and for some reason they don't fall under the Easter of Tofer and Shabbos. I don't know why. But the second issue.
So do you wear buttons on Shabbos or not?
What I do is neither here nor there. This is London. Now a talus cotton, which is sewn up and down the sides. Is no good for a talus because it doesn't have arba kanfot. In order to have arba kanfot, the majority, from the bottom up, the majority has to be open, and then it has arba kanfot, then it is chayav petzitzis. Now, all the poskim say, what about, let's get sewn. What if it has buttons? Well, if it has buttons, all of a sudden, that's not called tfira, like on Shabbos. And therefore, the corners are still called corners. I don't understand why. Right. As a mannequin, it's an unbelievable what they come up with. The
question just on about the buttons. So, the buttons on the unfastened, but the sewing, and that's kind of more practice for us. The sewing doesn't normally
Well, it has to do with being temporary or permanent. According to that, if the buttons on my shirt are broken, so let me go get needle and thread and temporarily sew it up, it's surely no more permanent than the buttons were, just as at night I'm going to have to unbutton, so at night I'm going to have to take out the thread, and that should be permitted? That sounds ludicrous to permit that.
Isn't the common item when you sew, you're doing it, whether I decide I want to do it temporarily or not, is irrelevant. People sew.
I don't know if Bar Kaiba has anything to do with Topher at all, but even assuming that it does have to do, so buttons are neither more nor less permanent than sewing. Well, for example, if I wish to close my shirt with needle and thread, just as 6 hours are going to pass between now and opening the shirt with the buttons, so exactly the same, 6 hours will pass between now and opening the shirt, taking out the thread.
Don't we define things just based on what society does in general, not because I'm making an exception. Doesn't count.
Okay, well, buttons can last forever unless you undo them. So, I don't know, deserves some thought. Shatnez also should be thought about. Let's just finish the proof of the Maharik. Huyo vehem yotzin betulsin, whatever that is. Afani etze betulsin, afani asekei. According to this Sifrei, the Maharik comes to the conclusion. Lo shayach la'asor mishum holeich achar hukotehem, ela heicha shadvarim marim shiyisrael midamer aleihem. Kegon she'oseh ma'asei ha'tameh, asher ein litlot tam ba'asiyatot, ela mitlot hukam. Something which has no rational explanation why I'm doing it. I'm not doing it because of a rational explanation. I'm doing it in order to imitate the goyim. That's what goyish and asur. Okay? Let us then pause with this at this time, and Amir Tzah Hashem will finish Monday.